Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Hermetic Hour, and I'm your host, Pope Runyon. It's May 27th, 2010, and tonight the subject that we will discuss, fascinating subject we'll discuss, is the Masonic Conspiracy. And we'll deal with this fascinating subject of conspiracy connections, if there are any, and we will discuss the actual and fanciful history of Freemasonry in relation to occultism, radical politics, the New World Order, and we'll go from the Illuminati through the French Revolution. We'll discuss the Morgan Affair and the Palladian hoax. We'll get into Fabian socialism a little bit and talk about Marxism. And we'll reveal to you just what the great secret of Freemasonry really is, and why the Masons are hated and feared by the fanatics and true believers of the world's great religions, and the followers of the world's most radical political philosophies. Now, we'll briefly review Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol. Now, we'll take calls at the last 15 minutes of the, because we have a lot of material to cover before we take calls. We'll take calls at the last 15 minutes, and this is a highly charged subject, so please make your questions brief and reasonable. So, at the sound of the gavel in the east, knock, knock, we will begin by discussing the actual as opposed to the fanciful history of Freemasonry. Now, Freemasonry supposedly began with the building of Solomon's Temple and came down to us through the Knights Templar, according to the legend, and it came in through the stonemasons, and there was the secret canon they used to build the cathedrals, and then finally it emerged as a philosophical society in early 1700s in England. Now, the truth of the matter is that we can't prove the Knight Templar connection. Nobody's been able to prove that. It's nice to think about it, but nobody's been able to prove it. And the story of King Solomon's Temple is actually an allegory that was created around about the time Masonry was brought about in the early 1700s. That's when the master's degree, the third degree, was added to the first two degrees of the Old Stonemasons Guild. Now, what happened was that the Old Stonemasons Guild was, you might say, infiltrated by gentlemen who were not actually stonemasons, and they became what was known as speculative philosophical masons, and they transformed very quickly on the Old Stonemasons Guild into a gentleman's club, where gentlemen and aristocrats and people who were professional people could meet and have dinner and have a few drinks and discuss the affairs of the day with the idea that they would be totally free from any form of religious prejudice or religious discussion, and even political discussions. You were supposed to, in Masonry, you were supposed to respect the other man's religion as well as much as you respected your own, even though you certainly were not told to give up your religion or anything like this. But the reason why Masonry was founded is frankly because the British had just been through a very, very nasty civil war, which had religious connotations, and the Protestants were against the Church of England, and the Calvinists were against the Church of England, and the Catholics were caught in the middle, and they were all killing each other in the name of religion. And so the British wanted to get away from this. They wanted to be able to have the Puritans and the Church of England people and the Catholics and all sit down together and get over this religious problem. So this is one of the reasons why Masonry was founded. And the other reason, of course, is that England was coming into democracy at this time. And the philosophy that Masonry really espoused was a Republican kind of philosophy. And the main philosopher behind Masonry, but the model for Masonry, I think, in my opinion, was John Locke. John Locke was a British philosopher who died just before Masonry was founded. But his philosophy was the philosophy of the Republic, and what became in England the constitutional monarchy. And John Locke, his philosophy was not radical. It was very well balanced, and he believed that people should own property, providing it, you know, the property that they own didn't conflict with the will of the people. In other words, you know, he didn't believe that property should be owned at the expense of the people, but he did believe in property rights, and he believed in representation. He believed in balance, check and balances in government. In other words, essentially, John Locke believed in the kind of government that developed in England and that we developed in the United States, and that was the philosophy that Masons espoused. It was freedom and dignity and equality, but all very well regulated, and in a well regulated society. Now, so Masonry, the main reason for the foundation of it was to have a place where men of these different religions and these different political views could get together without hating each other, without arguing with each other, and have brotherhood and be able to just generally bring an air of peace and prosperity to their work. And so this was started in England. And it, of course, had to be sanctioned by the Crown and by the Church of England. So it reverenced religion, and Masonry was very biblical. Now, what they did when they created the third degree, which actually made Masonry what it is today, 300 years ago, they created this third degree, this Master Mason's degree. Now, what the Master Mason's degree does is it makes an allegory out of the building of King Solomon's temple. Now, the idea here is that King Solomon wants to build the temple. David told him to build it, so he is charged to build the temple and to build it to God. So he goes to Hiram of Tyre, who is a Phoenician, Canaanite, a pagan, and he says, "I want to build a temple to the Lord, and will you help me?" And the Phoenician, Hiram of Tyre, says, "Yes." He says, "We worship the Lord too in our own way, and yes, we'll help you." So then Solomon, who had no idea of how to build a temple, And Hiram had the raw materials to build it, but Hiram of Tyre also had a master architect who was also named Hiram, Hiram Abiff. So King Hiram of Tyre brought Hiram Abiff into the temple project with King Solomon. So Hiram Abiff, now, this is important to remember, Hiram Abiff was the son of a Phoenician father, and his mother was a Jewish woman. So Hiram Abiff represented the common man of both Judea, Israel, and Phoenicia. He represented the common man of both countries, both the Jewish country and the pagan country. Now, he was one of the grand masters. King Solomon was one of the grand masters, and King Hiram was one. They had three grand masters. Now, all these three grand masters knew, and this is here again, very important to the allegory, they knew the secret word of a master mason. They knew this secret word. All three of them did. However, three men from Tyre became very jealous. Three of the workmen became very jealous, and they conspired to harass Hiram Abiff to give him the word. They wanted to threaten him to give him the word so they could have the word of a master mason, and he refused, and they killed him. They murdered him in the temple, and they never got the word. Well, and they went out and buried him. King Hiram and King Solomon dug him up, raised him out of the grave, and didn't bring him back to life, but they raised him out of the grave to rebury him elsewhere. And Solomon declared that the word's lost. Now Hiram's dead, and the lost word is lost. So we have to have a substitute word, because the word's lost. Now this, you have to realize that this is an allegory, and there's no possible way that this word could be lost in reality, because Hiram of Tyre knew it, and King Solomon knew it, and because Hiram Abiff is dead, that doesn't mean the word's going to be lost. So what they really meant by this was that this word that the two kings and the man who represented the common people, they all had this word, and what the word really meant was God. And it was a word that meant God in all three. It meant to the common people and to the king of Judea and to King Hiram of Phoenicia, it all meant the same thing. It meant God. But because Hiram, the common man, had been murdered, it meant that the common people were not really ready to understand that the same God was God for everybody. And this was the whole mystery of the lost word. And this is why the allegory was created. So what it means is that masons will work to find the lost word, and eventually we will find the lost word. What this means is that eventually, if we keep working toward the light, then eventually everyone in the world will respect everybody else's religion, because they'll realize that everybody else's religion is the best religion for them, and that they will find God their own way, and they have as much respect for that guy's religion as you have for your own. That's the ultimate goal. In other words, and oh boy, do we ever need that today? Because look what's going on in the Middle East and in Afghanistan and Iraq and do we ever need this concept? We really need it. So masonry has a very, very worthwhile purpose and a very worthwhile secret that it has. Now, this was what masonry was originally founded on, and this is what continues, of course, today. But English, British masonry, and American masonry, which came right from it, was based primarily on the philosophy of John Locke, which was reasonable and which was not radical and reasonable, and our forms of government come from that. However, and this is where things get, we're talking about this conspiracy and things like this. Over on the continent in Europe, the Masonry on the continent was not as influenced by John Locke as it should have been. It became more influenced by Rousseau. And Jean Rousseau was much more radical in his philosophy. Yes, he believed in equality. Yes, he believed in liberty. Yes, he believed in freedom and all of that. But the problem was, he didn't have any respect for God, and he didn't have any respect for tradition. He didn't have any respect for culture. And so consequently, what happened with Rousseau's philosophy, as we saw in the French Revolution, what happened was that it very quickly led to dictatorships, to totalitarian regimes. And so this is the difference in the two philosophies of two types of masonry. Now, I'm not saying that all continental masonry is radical, and there's a, but this Rousseauian influence was definitely involved, and especially in a group that got started in Bavaria called the Illuminati. Now, I know the conspiracy theory people was talking about the Illuminati. Well, the Illuminati was founded right, you know, a couple of months before the American Revolution, so they really didn't have anything to do with the American Revolution. And by the way, George Washington wouldn't allow them in the United States. And so, but the Illuminati were founded in Bavaria by Adam Weishaupt, and he was a professor at the University of Ingolstadt, and he was very, very much of a radical liberal. And he was hated the Jesuits, so he wanted to break Bavaria was a Catholic country, and he was essentially an atheist. And the original Illuminati structure had nothing to do with mysticism at all. It was strictly political, and it was Rousseau type radical politics. Adam Weishaupt was really almost more influenced by one of Rousseau's colleagues, Claude Helvetius, and Helvetius was even more radical than Rousseau. And so, the Illuminati, in order to infiltrate Masonry, which was one of Weishaupt's ideas, he wanted to infiltrate Masonry. But in order to infiltrate Masonry, he had to get mystical, because Masonry, being generally respecting God and having a spiritual quality to it, it needed some form of spirituality. So in order to make his Illuminati more popular for Masons, and so he could get the Masons into it, he brought on board a Masonic mystic scholar, Baron von Knigge, and Baron von Knigge really was a mystic. So Knigge liked the basic principles of the Illuminati, but he wanted to make it mystical. And so he did. So they managed to infiltrate. They only had a 10-year run before they got kicked out of from everywhere. But they infiltrated the Central European Masonic lodges, and especially after Baron Knigge got it going. And a few years, Weishaupt and Knigge came at loggerheads. They Weishaupt couldn't stand the mysticism, so he forced Baron Knigge out, and Knigge turned around and exposed him. And he just, and so that was the beginning of the end of the Illuminati. Now, the Illuminati didn't have that much influence on the French Revolution. The French had their own form of radicalism going over there in their lodges. But the Rousseauian thing, the basic same philosophy, was very much behind the French Revolution. That's one of the reasons why the French Revolution was a really, really terrible thing. And it was the bloodbath and the innocent people that were killed as a result of it was a presage of what was to come. And this sort of thing eventually ended up in Napoleon, and then of course it went on and on into Nazism and into Stalinism and communism. This is the outgrowth of the Rousseau philosophy, that was somewhat aided by continental masonry to some degree. Now, one of the things that happened over in the United States, and to get back to another part of Masonic history that's not anything that's kind of bad, but over in the United States, Masonry, still based on Locke's philosophy, was very, very much a part of the founding of the United States, and so many of the founding fathers were Masons. And so Masonry became a gentleman's, the same thing as England, it became an elite gentleman's club, and you really, if you wanted to be successful in politics and business, it was a good idea to be a Mason. And so the Masons had a lot of power in the United States back in the 1820s. In the 1820s, they were very powerful. And the common, the farmers and the poor people and the laborers and all, they resented this. They resented these wealthy businessmen and politicians and all having this secret society, and they were kind of simmering and resenting it. And then a fellow by the name of William Morgan, who was a member of one of the Masonic lodges, he was had some problems in his lodge, and then he got out, and then he just said, he announced that he was going to publish all their secrets. And he said, I'm going to publish all the secrets of Masonry. And actually what he was doing was he was trying to get the Masons to buy him off. Well, they wouldn't. And so he started printing his book, and his print shop burned down, and then he got arrested on a trumped-up charge, and then he somehow or other disappeared from the jail, and he was never found again. Now, nobody can prove that anybody really got rid of him, but it's a pretty good idea. It's pretty probable that his lodge brothers probably got rid of him. Well, this caused a furor in the United States. And the result was that Masonry was almost destroyed. The common people, the farmers and the laborers and the preachers, especially the fundamentalist preachers, and Christianity, of course, grassroots Christianity, was very, very strong in the country. And so there was this tremendous anti-Masonic movement. They even had a political party. The first third party in the United States was the anti-Mason party, and they just about wiped Masonry out. So, after we recovered from the Morgan affair, Masonry decided that, hey, we can't be elitist anymore. We got to have to take honest and responsible people from all walks of life, men from all walks of life, laborers, farmers, people with low incomes, providing they're responsible, providing they can pay their dues, which we would keep reasonable. And so Masonry reestablished itself as very egalitarian. It was available to all men, and all men of good report. In other words, you've got to be a good citizen, and you have to be able to be responsible. But other than that, as long as you don't have a felony, as long as you profess a belief in God, you can be a Mason. And, Masons don't invite you. You have to ask them. And so, consequently, anybody who petitions has a right to petition and become a Mason. So this meant that American Masonry no longer involved itself in politics, and it no longer involved itself in trying to run things. And each state had its own Grand Lodge. Now, so American Masonry really is not involved in, and never, and since the Morgan Affair, has not been involved in any kind of political conspiracies at all. Over in England, they're still more elite than we are. They and they have come in for some criticism over in England for being a little too secretive and very elite and all. But here again, they're still based on John Locke's philosophy, and they're not trying to overthrow governments or anything of that nature. And yet, as I said, the Rousseauian philosophy that influenced some of the Continental Masonic groups, it certainly was a bit radical. Now, I mentioned Fabian Socialism, and of course that's the Roundtable group and all of that. We might say that is, it does follow the John Locke current more so than it does the Rousseau current. Marxism, on the other hand, and all that follows the Rousseau, that follows the Rousseau current, and so Fabian Socialism, that's George Bernard Shaw and Cecil Rhodes and that group, the Roundtable group over in England. They were really not related to Marxism. This Marxism was off on its own, as I say, off on the Rousseau current. Now, Bertrand Russell, who's a very left-wing philosopher, Bertrand Russell said that in order to understand this, you'd understand that Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill were both descended from John Locke, whereas Hitler is descended from Rousseau. Now, if Bertrand Russell wasn't as left-wing as he was, he would have said Hitler and Stalin. But because he was very left-wing, he left Stalin out. But it's the same sort of thing. So you need to understand that even though this Fabian Socialism and that, of course, is supposed to be this control the CFR or be CFR is supposed to be an outgroup. This is all it's all descends basically from the John Locke philosophy. So actually, when we get down to great Masonic conspiracies, they really aren't, they're really not so conspiratorial when you understand what Masonry is supposed to do, what its principle is, and the currents, the philosophical currents that directed it. Now, we talked about the Illuminati, the French Revolution, the Morgan Affair. Now, let's get into some of this anti-Masonic stuff and find out where it comes from and what it uses. And anti-Masonry in the United States is primarily, almost all of it is generated by fundamental Christian and evangelical Christian groups. And there are not that many of them, and they don't have that many members, but they are very vocal, and they're very intense, and they even have, there are even some ministries, some of these evangelical and fundamental ministries, that their whole purpose is to go after and attack Masons. And they have very elaborate websites and publications and whatever. Now, I don't care on this program. I am not interested in trying to convert these people or take them, or to get them away from their views or to try to talk any sense into them. I can't possibly do this. There's no way that we can convert these people. And the reason why we can't is because they are the kind of Christians who believe that if you're not a Christian, you're their enemy. Anybody that isn't a Christian, as far as they're concerned, is some variety of Satanist. And they actually believe it. Or they think, at the very least, they think that if you're not a Christian, you're going to go to hell. And, of course, they claim that, so, oh, we feel sorry for you because you're going to hell. Actually, they don't like you. And the fact that Masons demand that in Lodge you show the same respect to the other man's religion that you have for your own, that in itself is enough to make them hate Masonry, and there's no way we can talk them out of it. Now, the truth of the matter is that in Masonry, there is nobody tries to get you to give up your religion or to modify your religion or to have it to be in any way give up your faith. Nobody in Masonry ever does. In fact, you're encouraged to keep your faith. You're encouraged to respect and to use your faith. Masonry is very biblical and Old Testament biblical. So consequently, the Muslim, the Christian, and the Jew in Masonry are all encouraged to keep their faith as strong as possible. It's just that we insist in Masonry that you respect the other man, his faith, and you respect his as much as you respect your own. That's it. But we can't keep the anti-Masons from hating us. And also, I want to point out that every totalitarian regime in this world has outlawed Masonry. They all have. And because Masonry is for freedom, for liberty, for the dignity and the rights of human beings. And so, consequently, that's why we're hated, and that's why we're feared. Now, this means that what I am trying to accomplish with this program and what I'm trying to get across is not to try to convert the fundamental Christians and the evangelicals that do this sort of thing. Can't do anything about them. However, they have spewed out so much false information that people who believe in conspiracies, who aren't necessarily fanatical religious people, but they do believe in conspiracies, and they do, so they swallow some of this stuff that the fundamentalists, the anti-Mason fundamentalists have put out. So that's what we want to try to debunk. And one of the ones that they really get a lot of mileage out of is the so-called Palladium, the satanic sex magic Palladian cult that supposedly was, according to the French hoaxer Leo Taxil, back before 1900, right before, at the end of the 19th century, this French tabloid writer and professional hoaxer, Leo Taxil, started a hoax in which he created the idea and tried to document the idea that Albert Pike, the founder of the grand old man of Scottish Rite Masonry of the United States, that Albert Pike had created a secret organization that was called the Palladium, and he had a very beautiful woman by the name of Diana Vaughan, an American woman, who was going all over Europe initiating the crowned heads of Europe and the captains of industry and all this into this Palladian sex magic cult, which was Luciferian or satanic. And Taxil wrote about this in these French tabloids. And it was like the National, I'm not going to insult the National Enquirer by it, because they just recently got a Pulitzer Prize. And so, no, but these French tabloids were really, really radical. And Taxil wrote for them. Taxil had been a Mason. He got kicked out of the Grand Orient for writing articles against the Catholic Church. And then no sooner did he get kicked out of Masonry than he joined the Catholic Church and then started writing against Masonry. And Daxel, he was really a professional hoaxer. He at one time sent a whole bunch of different forged letters into the French government complaining about the sharks in the Bay of Marseille. He said, it's swarming with man-eating sharks. And he sent so many of these letters in from that the French Navy got out there in the harbor of a warship, and they were dropping dynamite charges trying to kill the sharks that weren't there. The sort of an early version of Jaws, so that was one of Taxel's hoaxes. Another hoax is he said that there was a sunken city at the bottom of Lake Geneva, and people were going out there and trying to find the sunken city at the bottom of Lake Geneva. Well, when he started this Palladium hoax, he had a lot of fun with this thing, but he got it going to the point where Diana Vaughan was just really a character that people were believing in, and they believed this woman was sneaking around and doing this all at the direction of Albert Pike, who conveniently was already dead. So Taxel didn't have to worry about Pike complaining, because Pike was already dead. But anyway, finally he decided that he had he'd run this thing as far as he could go with it. So he finally put an end to it by saying that Diana Vaughan had converted to Catholicism and seen the error of her ways and had retreated to a convent, and that she was going to spend the rest of her life in prayer and doing good works to try to atone for her sins. Well, it was a secret convent, and of course he couldn't reveal where it was. Well, Taxel thought, I'm out of that, and I've finished that off, and I don't have to worry about that anymore. And yet, unfortunately, there was a knock at his door, and he opened the door, and there was the representative of the Vatican standing there and saying, Mr. Taxel, the Holy Father would like to visit Diana Vaughan in the convent and pray with her. At this point, Taxel thought, now I'm really in it. Now I've got to make a public confession. So he called a press conference. He got about 200 people together from all the newspapers and the church and everybody else. And he came out on stage and he made this confession. He said, I have to admit that Diana Vaughan is actually my secretary, and she was in it with me, and we created this whole thing. Well, they got so mad at him that everything they could throw at him, they threw at him. The gendarmes had to escort him out. Now, this public confession was printed in all the papers and whatever, and yet these, if you go on these anti-Masonic websites, you will find that they still believe this. They still believe that Albert Pike had sent Diana Vaughan out to seduce the all the important people in Europe, and that this was this satanic masonry. He even forged a letter from Pike saying that he was founding a Masonic lodge for women so that they could sexually service the Masonic brothers, and he forged this letter. But Pike was dead, so what could Pike do about it? And this is still considered by the anti-Masons to be a factual thing. Now, there's let's deal with Dan Brown's lost symbol, because we're getting down to when I want to take some calls. Dan Brown's lost symbol, for those of you who read it, it's in the main, and for the most part, very complimentary of Masonry, and those of us in the Masonic craft, we're very pleased with it. It has, however, it does misrepresent a couple of things I've discussed. Number one, sure, if you donated a couple million dollars to Scottish Rite, they might give you an honorary 33rd, but you'd have to go through a lot of masonry first in order to be able to do that, which is not made clear in the book. This fella just does this, and he gets his 33rd without all the rest of the Masonic work that he would have to do beforehand in order to do this, and that is not pointed out. One of the things that the lost symbol does that's not too good is it indicates that Masonry is much more powerful in Washington, D.C. than it really actually is. We don't have, I don't think that the government would be brought down if we knew who the Masons were in government. I don't think that this would happen. So this is a little exaggerated. But other than that, the book is entertaining and it's good. A little improbable, but it's really good. Now look, at this point, we got a few minutes left. Let's take some calls if we got any. Do we have any calls? We don't have any. So we don't have any calls yet. So what I will do for the remainder of this is we'll discuss the so-called New World Order idea that Masonry is supposed to be a part of. It really doesn't come from Masonry in the sense that Masonry has as a principle patriotism and extreme sense of pride in your own country. I almost said extreme, but a sense of pride in your own country and a sense of pride in your own religion, a sense of pride in your own civil structure. And so consequently, the idea that Masonry is somehow conspiring to have a one-world government is just not true. It's not in the nature of Masonry to be that way. Masonry, the nature of Masonry is to promote patriotism for your own country, and at least that's certainly the way it is in England and in the United States. And the one thing that you need to understand is that Masonry is not trying to be a religion. It's not. It's very biblical and all of that, but it doesn't try to be a religion. It tries to inculcate the idea that all men should respect each other's religion equally. And in this sense, so it's not this whole idea that Masonry is behind the New World Order, or if there is such a thing as a New World Order, it's not true. Now, one of the things that we should discuss here at the last of this, we all know this is the Hermetic Hour, and we all know I'm a magician, and we all know that of course we're in the OTA, we're occultists and practicing occultists, and so the question here is just how occult is Masonry? Well, not very. In fact, Masonry. The main influence on the occult that Masonry's had is in structure. Occult organizations like the Golden Dawn and the OTO and the various organizations, even Gardnerian witchcraft, are based on a Masonic model, and they're set up like a Masonic ritual. But that doesn't mean that the Masons themselves are occult. And Albert Pike, in fact, said several places, we are not teaching magic. We're teaching moral and philosophical lessons. We're not teaching occultism. And this is true. Masonry is not occult. Now, there is, however, some influence of Hermeticism, the Hermetic philosophy, in the third degree. Now, the third degree, the creation of the third degree, has a Hermetic element to it. And the Hermetic element, of course, is the idea of this one supreme name for God, the idea that each individual man is really just as divine as any other man, and he has the Spirit of God inside himself. And that aspect is Hermetic, and so that aspect can be said to influence the third degree of the Master Mason's degree. And yet, you know, that concept is the same concept that Meister Eckhart, who was a very devout Christian, Jacob Boehm, who was a very devout Christian, de Saint Martin, very devout Christian. This is a principle that Christian mystics agree with. It's a hermetic principle, yes, but they agree with it. So it's not a principle that a true, in my opinion anyway, that a true Christian or a devout Jewish person or a reverent Muslim would disagree with. This is, it's true that yes, the Hermetic tradition did influence Masonry into this extent. Now, but remember that Hermes Trismegistus was almost declared a saint before 1614. And in 1614, a philologist by the name of Casaubon proved, at least to his satisfaction, that the Hermetic treatises were written after the time of Christ, about 200 A.D., rather than before the time of Christ. And so they had to realize that these are pagan. They're not pre-Christian. They are post-Christian, so they got to be pagan. So all the statues of Hermes Trismegistus that had been erected in the Catholic churches in Italy had to be dragged out and broken up. And Hermes, you couldn't get an imprimatur on a magic book after that. And that was unfortunate because now present scholarship today realize that actually those Hermetic treatises, even though the particular ones that Casaubon analyzed, were they were written around 200 A.D., but the philosophy behind them was back before the time of Christ. So really, Hermes probably shouldn't have been taken out of the churches. And once you realize that, you realize that Hermes Trismegistus is not the enemy of the Christian church. It never was. And in fact, some of the most devout Christian mystics were definitely influenced by Hermes. And the Kabbalah, the Jewish Kabbalah, is very, very compatible with the Hermetic philosophical proposition. And also, Sufi Muslims have no trouble whatsoever relating to the Hermetic principles. So consequently, the idea that Masonry is somehow pagan, well, is it really? I don't know what's pagan, you know, when you think about it. So really, as I said at the beginning of the program, we can't possibly talk the anti-Masons out of their beliefs. Not with this program. That's not going to happen. But by gosh, I hope that those of you who are not in the fundamental anti-Mason camp, that have bought into some of this conspiracy stuff, I hope that maybe we made an impression on you, and that you will realize that really Masonry is not some deep dark conspiracy. And with that in mind, do we have any more? Do we have a call? We don't have any. Okay. Anyway, next week, because I think we've had a chance to pretty much cover this subject, I think next week we're going to deal with a new subject, and I'll put that out in an abstract, and we'll send it out. We'll have a new subject, and I would appreciate some feedback on some of this. So next week, if you want to call in and talk about this a little bit, you're certainly welcome to do so. We'll have a place where you can do that. Now, the one thing that I would like to end up with here is the idea that make sure you understand that that any adult male, any man who is doesn't have a felony on his record and can support himself and his family, or support himself, and he, in other words, he has a job and he can pay his dues, and the dues being very quite reasonable. Any man who can profess an honest belief in God can be a Freemason. It is not some closed group that you can't get into. And so we want to make sure that you understand that. We've covered in this broadcast, we've covered the history of Freemasonry, how it got started. We've dealt with briefly with the Illuminati, the French Revolution, the Morgan Affair, the Palladian hoax. We touched on the relationship of the philosophies of John Locke and Rousseau, and how John Locke influenced British and American Masonry, whereas Rousseau's philosophy was influential on continental Masonry. And we explained what the true secret of Freemasonry really is, and we discussed that in relation to why the anti-Masons hate us so much, and why Masonry is also hated by totalitarian groups everywhere. And we touched on Dan Brown's law symbol a little bit, and so we've just about covered the waterfront on this, and we will next week be back on station with another show, and we'll get more deeply into the magical tradition, and we'll take calls or feedback on this particular show. So, with that in mind, tune in next week, and we'll be on the same station in Blog Talk Radio, and we'll get together again. And meanwhile, have a good evening and good magic.